night for a few minutes.
And we started on the 16th chapter of Acts this morning, and we looked at the situation with Timothy and our introduction to him there, and I suspect we covered that pretty well. The chapter goes on describing the travels that Paul and Silas and I think we're going to find the introduction here that Luke is along with them, to the extent that instead of saying they or naming somebody, he's referring to we. So we get into what is commonly referred to as a Macedonian call, and it's a missionary type message that we usually end up with here. I'm going to skip over that because I don't think that to us today, in the circumstances that we're trying to cover, there's anything in particular there other than the fact that God directs our steps, and there are times that He opens doors and there are times that He closes doors, and quite often He does it in quite unmistakable ways. And we need to learn to recognize this and to accept it when He does. Now, we get to the stage now where they come to Philippi, and they're looking for a group of people who would be concerned. And my commentaries say there was no regular synagogue there. It takes a group of 10 Jews to start a synagogue. And apparently they didn't have that many there, but they're was a group who met down by the riverside for prayer and what we'd say Bible study today. And Luke says, we went down there, and that would include Luke and Paul and Silas and I don't know who else, but those three quite evidently were in the group. And they went down, they sat down with the women, and they taught. And we're told here that let's see, these people were Gentiles. Lydia was a Gentile, to the best of my knowledge, and what I've been able to come up with. No, I'm sorry, I'll have to back off of that. What I have here in this commentary says she was a, this was a group of Jewish women. All right, I'll take it back. I am correct. The first, she was meeting with a group of Jews, but she was a Gentile, all right? Let me put it that way. And she responded, among others, to the preaching of Paul, and she invited them to stay with them for some little time. Now that brings us up to verse 16, and I'm going to pick up there and go on, and this is something I believe I've spoken from, maybe from one viewpoint or another, since I've been here. I don't keep my records that exact sometimes, but my memory tells me that we have spoken from this particular portion of Scripture once before, and so there may be a little repetition, but we do want to look at it insofar as a lesson for us in it today. And I'm going to begin with verse 16. You follow along. It came to pass as we went to prayer, a certain damsel possessed of a spirit of divination met us, which brought her masters much gain by soothsaying. The same followed Paul and us and cried, saying, these men are the servants of the Most High God, which show unto us the way of salvation. And this she did many days. But Paul, being grieved, turned and said to the Spirit, I command thee in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her. And he came out the same hour. Now, what do we have here? We have a young lady who, according to the best evidence we have, was demon-possessed. And she was literally a slave to certain hackneys, magicians or soothsayers or fortune tellers who used her for the purposes of telling fortunes. Now, I don't know that she had any great power, but she was extremely accurate. The evidence we have is that she spoke a lot of gibberish, and the fortune tellers supposedly interpreted it and made it in the line of a prophecy. Now today, you know, we have a lot of this stuff in astrology and people foretelling the future, and you get somebody like, well, you can name a lot of them, I don't think I'm going to bother to name any of them, but you pick up some of these cheap newspapers in some of the magazine stores and so forth, and and even in the grocery stores, and they say, so-and-so predicts this for the next 6 months. And someone else, all the predictions for 1975 by all the famous fortune tellers and mind readers and people of this nature, and they go through and they make all the predictions. And the funny thing about it, and I've done this a couple times, I've clipped a couple of those and put them aside, and then a year later read them over to see just how they came out. And what you find is a certain small percentage that you or I or anyone else could come up with come out reasonably close, because most of the predictions are couched in general terms. You know, if you happen to be one of these people who picks up the newspaper and you read the astrology column that seems to be in all the newspapers today, that's a big thing, you'll find that if you read each one, there's some little thing that has about a 50-50 chance of occurring if you read it. You know, you're going to meet a new friend today, and be careful and don't overstep your bounds with your boss. It's a bad day to ask for a raise. Well, most any day in this day and age is a bad day to ask for a raise, you know. And you don't want to overstep your bounds with a boss. And there is a pretty good chance you're going to meet at least one new person during the day. So if you read that early in the morning, you know, you're looking around for the new person you're going to meet, and you're very careful how you treat your boss, and you don't ask for a raise, and at the end of the day say, oh, new salesman came in today, I met a new man, you know, I met somebody new today, and I had a good day because I didn't pick on the boss, and I was smart enough not to ask for a raise, all right? You know, I think I could sit down, I could write these things very well, and come up with a pretty good percentage. All right, now what I'm saying is, this young lady probably was used in this fashion, and was used to dupe a lot of people. But the fact of the matter is, she was demon-possessed, and the demon had the same basic knowledge to recognize the hand and the works of God that the demon-possessed man in the first chapter of Mark, I believe it was, where Jesus met him and cast him out. And he called Jesus by name, called him the Son of the Most High, the Son of God, and so forth. And this spirit could have been the same demon, the same type of possession, but the fact of the matter is, he recognized these men as those who taught salvation. Now, I sometimes get a little puzzled over the fact that a demon would go around advertising the works of God, you know. But the fact of the matter is, this did occur. You have something?
There is no joke.
Sure.
Very thing. It says, every word of this, speaking of these men, are the servants of the Most High God, who show unto us the way of salvation. Every word of this is true. But the purpose of Satan then was to discredit the message of the apostles by making the people think that they were in league with demon spirits who were making this announcement through a demon-possessed medium. The people would conclude that they were doing miracles by the devil and so discount the gospel. When the demon was cast out, the name of Jesus proved that they were of God and not of demons.
Okay. That's probably very logical reasoning, and it would apply and fit in with what Paul did. You know, he put up with this for several days, and I think we see a little bit of it today in some groups along this line, but it's awfully hard for you and I to spell it out, and I prefer to be rather careful in what I pronounce a being of God or being of the devil when I see something that I'm not totally familiar with. Paul seemed to put up with this for some time, and it's obvious he came to the conclusion that what was going on was an error, and he turned and he literally cast out the demon. He came out of the woman in that hour, and it says in verse 19 then that when her master saw what happened, their hope of gain was gone. Why, you know, they got upset. And they got Paul and Silas. I wonder how Luke got out of it. But they got Paul and Silas. They took them to the marketplace and made a lot of noise. And then into the magistrates. And, you know, you're on the verge of a little civil upset here. And so the magistrates went along with the mob. And they had Paul and Silas beat and thrown in jail. Verse 23 says, when they laid many stripes upon them, they cast them into prison, charging the jailer to keep them safely. Now, he was given specific instructions. And the custom in that day was that if you lost a prisoner who might be judged of death, then you took his penalty. I remember when I was in the service, we sometimes got the duty of walking guard on a man from the stockade. And they gave you an unloaded shotgun in most instances. Sometimes they gave you a loaded M1 rifle too. But a lot of times they gave you an unloaded shotgun. But in any case, they told you if you let the man go, you were going to end up taking the rest of his sentence in the stockade. I don't recall I ever ran into anyone who let a prisoner go or who had to follow through and take another man's sentence, you know. It made most of the young recruits who had these guns put in their hands a little conscious and a little cautious, and I can recall doing this and having men say, "Oh, you're not going to shoot me. You'd let me go if I run away, and you have to put on a mean face and say, 'Try me,' you know." And he doesn't know you've got an unloaded gun. He doesn't know whether it's loaded or not. Some days you had loaded guns, sometimes you didn't. So I never had anybody take a chance on me, and I never was put in a position where I even had to think about shooting a man. But this jailer was much in that particular position. And he puts him in prison, verse 24, and he's not going to take any chances. He even puts their feet in stocks. Now, this wasn't an unusual thing. It was done, from what I'm able to find out, these Turkish jails were rather ramshackle type things. Sometimes they were cut into stone, but the doors and the hinges and so forth weren't anything any too great. The stocks were a form of punishment plus an added security. If you had your feet locked in these stocks and there was any other way to get out, why, that usually precluded you moving any. And so this is a situation that Paul and Silas are in, and verse 25 tells us they started off with a prayer meeting and they ended up singing and praising God. Now, I've heard a lot said about this. I guess I'd agree with most of it. It's probably what you and I would do if we were put into jail and put into jail together and we had the opportunity to do it. We'd probably spend some time praying, and we might even reach a stage where we sang a little bit and praised God if I could sing. Paul and Silas seem to have done this, and the other prisoners heard them. And in the midst of all of it, there comes an earthquake. Now, I've heard people say, well, this was a normal, natural thing. God used it. Others say it was something, sin of God, specifically for the purpose. I don't think it makes a terrible lot of difference. The fact of the matter is, there was an earthquake. And God used it, or God sent it. And the very foundations of the prison were shaken. The doors all fell down and were opened, and the bands on the stocks were opened. Now, I'd say that would have to be a rather unusual earthquake, and I'd be inclined to think that this is an earthquake designed of God for the specific purpose and for no other purpose. In any case, the keeper of the prison, he wakes up, and as I understand it, he'd have a little apartment off to the side of the prison. And by the time he got out and pulled up his pants, you know, and ran out the door and came through and found all the doors open, why, he'd be sure all the prisoners were gone. And he'd be sure that these guys were in dire straits, and he was in trouble. Now, I suspect that among the other prisoners, there might have been some rather dangerous characters. I don't know how many was in there, but we know that there were other prisoners, plural. Two or more, at least. I couldn't tell you how many. I couldn't tell you what they were in there for. But there is a very strange thing. I'd be tempted to skip ahead. Well, verse 28. You know, he's there, and he sees what's happening, and you kind of have to visualize it. These cells, you know, they're kind of dark inside. I suspect there are no windows. The only light that would be what might be a lighter darkness behind the door where the jailer is. Inside would be darker than the area that the jailer came from, and he'd come, he'd look and see that the doors are all standing wide open. The stocks, apparently, he's able to detect that they're open, but he can't see people. And so he's on the verge of committing suicide. He takes his sword out, and he's not there to chop any prisoners' heads off if he can see it. It's obvious he's going to kill himself. And Paul and Silas are able to see this and detect it from the interior darkness where they are. And you know what most of us would do? We'd nudge Silas. Let him kill himself, then we can get out. You know? But Paul and Silas aren't quite that way. And Paul particularly isn't that way. He calls out in a hurry, and in a loud voice says, hold it. Don't do yourself any harm. And he doesn't say, Paul and Silas are still here. But he says, we are all here. Now, that puzzles me a little bit. I get the impression that all of the prisoners were totally free to go. And I have the impression from the tone of the scriptures here that there was sufficient time for them to clear the jail and be well on their way down the streets of the city. And I, because of this, I consider it to be no amazing thing that Paul has the right to say, we are all here. It would incline me to think, and here again I'm inserting an opinion, that the prayer meeting and the gospel sing and the praises to God had turned into a little bit of a witness and an evangelistic service. And I would think that Paul and Silas, in the hours that they had in jail, had probably won the other prisoners over to themselves and to Christ. It's the only reason I can see that the other prisoners didn't get up and knock Paul and Silas down getting out the door. They're willing to trust the God of Paul and Silas to do whatever he will do. We don't have any record of the other men in that prison at all, anywhere that I can recognize. But I think that when we get to heaven, it might be a nice thing for us to look into. Who were they? What did they do? Why didn't they leave? I would suspect that Paul and Silas, in their praises, were saying, our God can get us out of here. Our God can open the doors. Our God can loose us from these bounds. There isn't anybody that can touch one of God's children. You know, a little testimony meeting? And when the earthquake comes along, and all the bonds fall off, what do you think those people thought? Interesting. The fact of the matter is this, we always make a great deal of what happened to the jailer. But I ain't thinking of the prisoners. My experience has taught me that men in jail, believe it or not, are quite receptive to the gospel if it's presented in the right way. They're quite receptive to the Christian witness. Now, I also know from my own personal experience that there are a great many of them who will try to put on salvation as a cloak and will try to con you and fool you. There's a lot of expert con men in jail, but I'll tell you a little secret. There's just as many con artists in the churches today who try to put on and tell you there's something better than they are. I'll tell you, there's a lot of con men among preachers who will try to convince you they are something that they are not. Turn on your radio and see what you read. The fact of the matter is here that I'm convinced that these prisoners were pretty well converted by the time the earthquake came. And I'll tell you something else. I'm convinced that God sent the earthquake at just exactly the right hour. Probably very early in the morning. They probably had anywhere from 7 to 12 or 14 hours in that jail. And that's plenty of time to get us through a good, strong witness. Now, we've said that these messages were being brought in the light of what they have to teach us. And the thing that I get out of here, for me as a Christian today, is be prepared. Boy Scout motto again. Be prepared for whatever God sends you. Be prepared at any time to answer for the reason of the hope and the joy that you have in your life that must show through as a Christian. A true Christian is going to exude a form of confidence that isn't common to the world. I think that the ultimate point in Christian experience that we ought to be aiming for isn't some kind of a cloud-nine experience, but a situation where people look at us and recognize an obvious difference. And the life we lead would rouse a natural curiosity. There should be a willingness to speak quickly the name of the Lord and the glory of the Lord and the power of the Lord to save the soul. Now that's not just, you know, take you out of your nasty, dirty old sin and clean you up. God does that. It's a first and foremost step. But the fact of the matter is, there's a great number of people who are attracted to the gospel by what they can get out of it. And I have no objection to that. There's a lot of people saying, that's wrong. Don't come to the gospel for what you can get out of it. I don't object at all. I think these prisoners, at this stage, were looking for deliverance from jail. And when the deliverance came, and they realized what God could do on the basis of the probable testimony of Paul and Silas, then they were willing to sit back and take it as God dished it out. Now that's a lesson you and I need to learn. You might be in jail. There's all kinds of jails, you know. You might be bound physically because of your health, or mentally because of your problems and things that you're in. But God can utilize those things. Whatever your circumstances are, He can put you in a position where He can use you in those circumstances. Now, I think that's sufficient for the prisoners. Everything I've said is conjecture, with the exception of the fact that the Word of God says all the prisoners were there. When Paul said, "We are all here," he was speaking for every prisoner in that place. And the jailer had time to come in and shut the door and keep them all there if he wanted to. The record tells us he called for a light. He probably stood right in the doorway. It may well be that nobody wanted to trample him to get out. They might have been a little bit afraid of the sword in his hand. But I'm still inclined to think that they had plenty of time before he got there to get out if they'd wanted to. I'm sure Paul and Silas didn't. I'm sure that being children of God, they had presence of mind to do so. But the jailer, you know, he's amazed at this. I don't think he believes it in verse 29 totally. He calls for a light. The lantern's brought. He jumps in. He says he sprang in, and he came trembling. Now, he wasn't a bold, courageous man. I got a kind of feeling that he's kind of a Casper Milquetoast type jailer. And that's entirely possible, you know. You don't kind of always believe that. But, you know, the big, strong, ferocious-looking guy isn't always the bravest, most fearless individual you've ever met. There was an article in the newspaper last week. I don't know whether any of you saw it. About the man who weighed some 370 pounds. He had gotten on a kind of a beer binge and got very heavy, and so he was on a, what was it, milk diet? Milk diet. And he got down to 180 pounds, and or 170 pounds, something like that, and he was very trim, but he was very unhappy. Because when he had been drinking a lot of beer, he was very big. And he felt very strong, and he was very imposing, and everybody left him alone. He said, now he was terribly afraid. He said he could walk the street and swagger, you know, and nobody would come near him. He was just too big to tackle. He said, but if a little guy came after me, he said, he could have backed me in the corner and beat me up. He says, and now I've lost the weight. He says, I'm afraid. That's literally what he was saying. I'm afraid. He said, I'm going back on my beer diet and get fat again. So, now, you know, I'm not giving the guy credit, but what I am trying to say is, you know, there's a lot of big, ferocious-looking guys who are really afraid of their own shadows. And it may well have been that this man was this way. You kind of get that picture from what we see here. And I'm not belittling him. I think all of us can have some of this in us. He falls down before Paul and Silas, and he brings them out. I guess into the fresh air, and he says, gentlemen, sirs, what do I have to do to be saved? Now, my commentaries say they don't quite know what he meant exactly by being saved. They don't know, and let me see if I can find where that is worded here. It is not clear what the jailer meant by his question about salvation. Had he listened to the preaching of Paul and Silas? Had he heard the fortune teller declared that these men proclaimed the way of salvation? In any case, whatever it was, God blessed his, well, I can't pronounce the word, his little bit of faith. He and his household were baptized. All right, now, That's what the commentary has to say about it. They don't know where he picked up the little bit of faith he had. Was he asking for salvation in the terms that we think of salvation? Was he thinking of it in some other term? We don't know. But the fact of the matter is, it's obvious that Paul and Silas gave him a very quick but thorough gospel lesson upon the meaning of salvation and the source, the one and only source of salvation. And I think you and I, again, this is a lesson for us, should be quick to give the answer for whatever may come up. Now, I had an instance like this last week, and you wonder why my car breaks down so often. Well, you know, I work in San Leandro, and the place I bought the car from is in Oakland, and I have to ride BART. And I left the car there. They towed it away on Monday, and I thought I was going to be able to get it on Tuesday or Wednesday, you know, one little broken hose. And when they towed it away, the service manager asked me if I wanted another car to drive. And I said, well, you'll get the part in a day or two. I don't need it. I can ride with the wife, so forth and so on, you know. But I thought, well, I better be sure I've got one for the week. And I said, but, I said, if you keep it longer than a week, remembering what happened with the motor, 7+ weeks, I said, if I don't have a car for the weekend, I'll have to pick up one Thursday or Friday. And he said, okay, fine. So when it got to Friday, and I hadn't heard anything, and I called the guy, and he said, oh, they don't have that part anywhere on the West Coast, you know. I had to ride BART. That's Bay Area Rapid Transit, in case you don't know what BART is. We call it Black BART. That's bandits. In Oakland. Now, it's really kind of a nice system. But some of the seats face each other. And I don't know, I can't tell you this minute why it went just this way. But I sat in a seat facing forward, and I went one stop, and the car was pretty well loaded. And this young girl got on and sat in front of me. Now, I had no way of telling you how this conversation came about. But she had a little book there, and she was opening it and closing it. And she had another book on top of it, and I could not see the cover. But she'd open it, and she'd look at it, and she'd close it. Well, that clued me in a minute. I think she's memorizing, okay? And so I used that as an opening with her. I said, you're memorizing. And she just lit up all over. And I was reasonably sure she didn't have a Bible, but I had a feeling about her. And she said, yes. I says, I can't do that. I says, I admire people who can. And then just out of the clear blue, I said, you're memorizing Greek. Now, how did I know that? I don't know. She said, yes. I said, why are you studying Greek? She says, oh, to get a better understanding of the Bible. Okay, that was quite an opening. And so then I went into it deeper, and she's a Catholic. I had about 4 stops, which is about 15 minutes. The whole trip is about 21 minutes. She claims to be a Christian, but I don't know that she really means. She means it, or knows for sure, but she is vitally interested in the Bible to the extent that she's studying Greek and memorizing Greek in order to better understand the Bible. Now, she is, the way she expressed it, I'm trying to remember the words, but primarily it's a philosophy. Okay? That's not quite enough. And so I've had the golden opportunity that God presents once in a while to put in a couple of little needles. Good. But do you believe what you read? Yeah, it's a good guide to living. Yeah, but does it affect you? See, I could come around very gently, and in the few minutes I had, with 2 or 3 people sitting there, you know, there's 4 in that seat, and then 2 or 3 across the aisle, all ears propped up, listening, you see, just to get her to thinking that there is something more in that New Testament than just a philosophy and a way of life. It is a way of life. It is a good philosophy. I won't argue that at all. But does it get inside of you? Studying it in Greek, does it get it inside of you? Does it make a change for you? And she was thinking when I left, and she wasn't unhappy about what she was thinking. All right, here's this prisoner. And the evidence we have is total and complete. The little bit of time that he had been associating with Paul and Silas, he knew he had a lack. He knew there was something unusual in these men who wouldn't get out and run away when the prison doors fall down. There has to be something different in a man like that. And whatever his question was and whatever the motivation behind it was, it's quite obvious from the scripture that we have that he was led to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. More than that, he received the compassion in his heart for his fellow man that caused him to bring Paul and Silas in, wash their stripes, feed them, and love them. And then to have his family all come in and hear the good news, to be converted and be baptized. You can't ask for any more than that. And I think any Christian ought to be willing to take the stripes and the beating and to go to jail if it would bring that much. You know, you and I want to be able to sit in our homes and turn our TVs on and see the world go by and get irritated if the phone rings and interrupts us from our TV. God brings different opportunities into our lives in various disguises. The thing that you and I need to pray about more and more is, hey, Lord, open my spiritual eyes so I can see the opportunity. What's it say?
Sanctify the Lord God in your heart, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asks the reason of hope is in you and people's affairs.
All right. Now, I could go further. It's quitting time. I will suggest you go a few verses down. You'll find that while they're in the house and they're being fed and cared for, and I'm sure in my own mind the other prisoners were being fed and cared for too. I believe this was a jailer who had a totally different attitude. Now, my commentaries say it was the jailer's prerogative to do what he was doing. He could treat a prisoner any way he wanted, just so long as he was able to deliver him to the authorities the next day when they called for him. I suspect that this became a very Christian jailer and his jail changed. In any case, the next day the message came down, turn him loose. We really haven't got anything to hold him on. But I get a big kick out of Paul. Hey, wait a minute. You can't do that to me. I'm a Roman. You don't get rid of me that easy. And while it doesn't say so here, I strongly suspect these magistrates, these judges, these policemen, when Paul got through saying I'm a Roman, and I think his motivation for it was to gain me a little time so I can tell them the good news. Now, apparently, if he did this, there was no result. It's not recorded here. So that may be or may not. I don't think Paul or Silas or any of the other heroes of the New Testament were ever 100% successful. They spoke to many, it's quite obvious, who wouldn't receive the word. But knowing Paul and Silas, and knowing that they'd just come out of jail, and the results they had here, and how they must have been bubbling, good old Paul says, the thought occurred to him, oh, they're going to send us away. Wait a minute, I got some more to say to those fellows. Let them know I'm a Roman. They can't do that to a Roman citizen, you know. And he laid it on them, and this shook them up. They had no right to treat a Roman the way they treated what they thought was just a Jew. They could do that to a Jew, but they couldn't do it to a Roman. And it's obvious from the next few verses, they wanted to get Paul and Silas out of town quick under the best possible circumstances before anything else happened. Get this hot Roman, this hot potato, out of town before we get between him and the Jews, because it's going to be rough. This isn't any guy to mess with. And you know something? I know some people who are going to tell me I'm wrong. But I think there are times when a Christian needs to let the world know he's a hot potato, don't mess with him. It's nice to say we're Americans, but that don't carry much weight in this world anymore. I don't mind telling somebody I'm a child of God, keep your hands off me. That's the best protection I have, and I'm not ashamed of it. God will take care of me. All right. That's it. I don't know for sure where we're going to pick up next week, but I'm sure that the next two messages we have, and possibly the third one the following week, will pretty well close us out of the book of Acts. And when we come back, we're going to get into some much stronger material in the epistles, and we're going to go straight through them. Be praying.
You know, when you